and Jeffrey Clark being joined, not virtually, by Lucas Spitzel.
Nani?
No, we are actually meeting each other face to face for this one, and we decided a long time ago that this episode was too important for us not to do this face to face. Keep in mind, we started this when the pandemic was still running wild, but because the pandemic is, for all intents and purposes, over, we have decided it's safe again, but just for practicality purposes, we kept on doing this virtually. But there are a couple of episodes in which we decided we just could not do this when we were looking at each other through a screen, and this is one of them.
No, this is 100% one of them. Given the circumstances of everything, like, yeah, it's been tough, you know, with young kids at home, for me in particular, I don't have easy access to be able to get away a ton of the time. And so it's, all right, get everybody off to bed. We'll go record in an evening, go get all that taken care of. Jeffy works his black magic editing after the fact, and you get your weekly releases towards the end of the week. And we're recording a little bit early this week, just with how schedules worked out. But yeah, I mean, managed to make a 15-minute drive from work to the Palatine Library District. Thanks to them for providing space for us as we dig into an episode that we have been teasing and giving little bits and nuggets about for almost 2 years, if not over 2 years at this point. And let's get into it, shall we?
Well, let's get into this, but first of all, we have to mention that for the second time in 3 episodes, we have the inside knowledge of a special guest. Again, not live because the schedule just did not work out, but Mike Struben was a college classmate of ours. I only remember seeing him once during our time at North Central College, but he had a very unique job for a college student. At the time we started college, he was a bat boy for the Chicago White Sox. And his first time doing this job was during the season that we are talking about today. The 2005 season, he was 16, just like I was 16 in 2005. So you're probably wondering, how does one become a bat boy in 2005 for the Chicago White Sox? Well, let's turn it over to Mike.
Typically, they hire through De La Salle High School, just right over the highway there. I was fortunate. My neighbor, he was the clubhouse manager at the time. He had a daughter my age, so we used to carpool to school together. So I got to know him pretty well, and he got me the job part-time in 03 and 04. And then I started full-time in 2005 once I was turned 16. I couldn't actually like be on the field until I was 16. That was just an MLB rule. I was actually bummed out because I was initially supposed to start in 2004. I even had my 04 jerseys and everything made, but something happened the last second. It was so long ago, but there was a rule change. I was only 15 at the time, and there was a rule change where you had to be 16. So at the last second, I got the bad news that I couldn't do it in 04 full-time, and I had to wait till 2005 to start. So once I was 16 in 05, and the start of the spring, that's when I started full-time.
Thanks, Darren Baker, by the way.
Indeed. So we have to ask the question, what was it that these bat boys did on a regular basis?
Oh, man, we did everything. So I went to Marist High School on the south side, and I would leave right from school. So I got out around 2:10, and I'd drive straight to the ballpark. And like I said, we did a little bit of everything. We'd have to just kind of maintain order of the clubhouse. We'd do their laundry. We set up for BP, make sure like the coolers are stocked for food and everything. We'd make small like meals for them pregame, postgame. We'd cater, you know, food for them. So we had to get that all set up. We'd have to tear it down, restock coolers at the end of the night, clean all their shoes. I mean, we jack of all trades. We did a little bit of everything.
And of course, Mike was not doing this by himself. He had the help of some fantastic individuals.
Oh, the best, honest to God, I mean, clearly the 05 season was, you know, a memory of a lifetime, but the best part of my experience was those guys. All those guys are still my close friends today. Mooney's a teacher over at De La Salle High School, as is Timmy Coletti. Out of the four of us, three of us are teachers. Timmy, a math teacher, myself, math. Richard is a social studies teacher. And Bafia, he still works there. He's since moved up from bat boy status to the assistant clubhouse manager. So, and well-deserved. I mean, he was there. He still started in 2003, and just a salt-of-the-earth guy. He was a favorite amongst the players. You know, when things had to get done, Boffy was kind of your go-to guy. He would always be the one to take the cars for car washes, or he'd even give the guys haircuts. I mean, he did everything. He found his niche, and he worked his way up the right way just through some hard work. I've kept in contact with him through the years, and I'm on the outside now. It's a different perspective, but, you know, if I wanted a little bit of an inside scoop or some insight that I used to have, I'd always text him, and he'd provide me a little bit. Like, he was, I know, really close with Tim Anderson, and when I was still working with them, he was extremely close with Mark Burley, and to my knowledge, he's still pretty tight with him today.
So, as you can probably guess by now, one of the combatants for this 2005 World Series, my Chicago White Sox. And we have to talk about how they got here before we talk about the World Series that is nearest and dearest to my heart. The first year that manager Ozzie Guillen was at the helm, they finished only a few games above 500, and changes had to be made. So they did not bring back Jose Valentin or Maggie Ordonez. They let him walk via free agency, a couple of power hitters. And then probably the biggest move that involved getting rid of power hitters, the trading of Carlos Lee to the Brewers, El Caballo, for the National League stolen bases leader from the season before, Scott Podsednik, along with reliever Luis Vizcaino. But that was just only the tip of the iceberg. They brought in Jermaine Dye, a name that we have talked about in the past. They brought in catcher A.J. Pierzynski. They brought in reliever Dustin Hermanson, who would serve as the closer for most of the year. And another guy by the name of Orlando El Duque Hernandez, whom we have talked about several times, and also the Japanese import second baseman Tadahito Iguchi. So a lot of moves were made by GM Kenny Williams to reshape this roster in the vision of his second-year manager, Ozzie Guillen.
I remember Scott Podsednik because he had come up with the Brewers, and I got to see him in a Brewers-Cubs game at Wrigley from the bleachers and remember somebody yelling at him of, you know, Podsednik, if you weren't with the Brewers, you'd be in the minors. The Brewers were a god-awful team at the time. Podsednik obviously acquitting himself very well and was exactly the engine that this White Sox team needed. I kick myself a little bit because on Immaculate Grid not super long ago, I had, I think it was White Sox and 100 runs came up as one of the combinations. I tried to put Scotty Pods in and no dice. Go figure.
Well, Scotty Pods, going back to your minor league benching, by the way, he did play for our local farm team, the King County Cougars, when he was on his way to the major leagues. But he did have a fantastic season, 59 stolen bases. And he was dating a Playboy model at the time, so lucky him, not to mention he was selected as the last man on that year's All-Star team for the American League. And he joined fellow All-Stars Paul Konerko, who was already a mainstay for the White Sox. Mark Burley was also a mainstay for the White Sox, so was John Garland. And Mark Burley would lead the American League in innings pitched 236 2/3. John Garland looked like for a while he was going to win 20 games. He ended up winning 18, and he also fired 3 complete game shutouts. And he supplemented very well a rotation that consisted of a couple of guys who were acquired the year before, Freddy Garcia and Jose Contreras. And you also have Aaron Rowan and Joe Creed in the everyday lineup, Juan Uribe. Carl Everett was mainly the designated hitter. Frank Thomas was on the team as well. He's on the back end of his career at this point. Unfortunately, he only got in about a month's worth of at-bats before he was sidelined with an injury for the rest of the season. But he played well in a limited role. In fact, in one of the games I attended that year, he did hit a home run. So I've set up the team pretty nicely. How do they do? Well, they got off to the best start in team history. In fact, I remember that they held a lead in a record first 37 games. They went 27-10 in those games. And they played so well that they were up 15 games on August 1st in the historically inept American League Central. And it looks like that the Twins were going to be their biggest threat, but not to be. Cleveland ended up getting really hot after the All-Star break to the point where they cut that lead to 1.5 games. Think about that. 15 games up on August 1st. By September 22nd, that lead had fallen to 1.5 games. And I was actually at the game in which they fell to 1.5 games. They lost an extra innings to the Twins. It had helped a couple of nights before that Joe Creed had walked Cleveland off. And I know I have trouble letting things go. My dad had switched the channel before that greedy home run because we had just gotten digital cable and he was checking out all the movie channels. I promise that's the last I'm going to talk about this. But in any event, the Sox were able to stave off this late Cleveland run. And about a week after they fell 2.5 games, they clinched in Detroit. And it was good because they were able to wrap up the division before a 3-game series at Cleveland, which they ended up sweeping. So it was no longer a consequential series. They ended up leading the American League in sack bunts, 53. They tied Cleveland for the league ERA lead at 3.61. They also tied three other teams with 9 complete games. And the craziest thing about this is that even though they won 99 games, 61 of those were by 2 runs or fewer. That's 61.6% of those wins. So as Billy Pierce says in the World Series film, when you're winning games by 1 run all the time, you're always under pressure. It didn't seem like pressure bothered them at all. We'll get more into that from Mike when we get to it. But just crazy to think that even though they won 99 games, the pressure was never really off of them during that entire regular season.
Yeah, the White Sox going 35-19 in one-run games over the course of that season. That's about a 65% clip. If you go by the Pythagorean win-loss and that kind of factors in, you know, run differential and everything, this was a 91-win team by that. So, I mean, they overachieved by about 8 games. Their longest losing streak during the course of the season, there was a 7-game skid in mid-August that, you know, that was during the time when Cleveland was making that big run. And I remember that during that summer and, you know, seeing something maybe about a month into the year about, you know, oh, there's no way the White Sox are going to be able to maintain this. And they almost didn't, but able to pull it out in September. And here they are as they then make a run into the postseason, get the city behind them, and have a tough test pretty much immediately in the defending World Series champion Boston Red Sox, which is still a little weird to think about in hindsight, but no real problems there. The White Sox get through them in 3 straight, and then a very interesting ALCS with a tipping point game in game 2.
Yes, they lost game 1, then after Mark Burley went the distance, at least theoretically, in that second game, the game was tied. A.J. Pierzynski swings that ball in the dirt for the 3rd strike and the base is empty. And Josh Paul, a former White Sox catcher, threw the ball back to the mound thinking that he had caught the ball. But because it was such a borderline non-call, I guess you could say, by home plate umpire Doug Eddings, Pierzynski, who had a similar situation when he was with the Giants the year before, decided to take off for first base because Paul had not tagged him out, which is like catching 101. And he runs to first base, and everybody is really confused by this. And long story short, despite some protests from Mike Socha and the Angels, who just won the World Series a few years before this, Pierzynski is awarded first base. He gets pinch run for by the speedy Pablo Ozuna. He steals second base, and Joe Creedy has a ball that's hit all the way to the left field while Ozuna scores. The White Sox win the game. And then they sweep 3 in Anaheim by virtue of 4 straight complete game victories going back to that second game, the ALCS, first time since 1928 that that's happened. It will never happen again, I can guarantee that. And they are going to the World Series for the first time since 1959.
Staunch anti-White Sox me back in the mid-2000s was not particularly happy about that drop third strike, quote-unquote. I remember watching that play and going, like, that did not hit the dirt. Now, obviously, with all of that, I remember that play. I didn't remember it being in the bottom of the ninth, so, you know, it was nice to get that refresher. But even if you take that being awarded first base off the board, you still have extra innings to go. Who knows if Mark Burley would go for a 10th inning or not. And even if the Angels were able to score in one of their halves in extra innings and stave off the White Sox inevitable counterattack there, I don't know that that changes the absolute dominance that the Sox rotation would have had in Southern California. And so, I mean, grand scheme of things, it seems like a big play. And maybe from the sense of, I don't know if I want to say momentum, but just kind of how the vibe of the series was going, like, it seemed like it turned on that particular play. But Michael Clark Duncan, the narrator of the World Series film and Chicago native, made mention of, you know, momentum is only as good as the next day's starting pitcher, and we saw how that worked for the White Sox.
And let me just go back to the regular season real quickly. First of all, let's hear from Mike about how that regular season went from his perspective.
Man, And I was spoiled right off the bat because, like I mentioned, that was my first full-time year. I worked a handful of games in 03 and 04, so you're not there on a day-to-day basis to really understand, like, the culture and the vibe of the clubhouse. And even in 05, like, I was just a 16-year-old kid, a baseball White Sox fan for sure, but never experienced anything like this. And honest to God, I mean, we knew something was special, but, you know, it wasn't the mindset that, oh, this is it, we're going all the way. It was just kind of day by day, game by game, and that's just kind of how it unfolded.
And then one other thing I want to say about this regular season from my own perspective, it was my junior year of high school that fall. By this point, it was well established amongst my peers that I was a big White Sox fan, maybe the biggest in the entire class. And I mentioned a few episodes back that I had a history teacher who had newspaper front pages of the White Sox getting eliminated by Seattle in the 2000 ALDS. Well, that same teacher, when the White Sox were in their little swoon, had a couple of days in which he had taken that morning's Tribune Sports page and put it in the front of the class on a stool, as if to taunt me. And if that wasn't bad enough, I had a chemistry teacher at the same time. One day in class, he told me to stand, and he started walking up to me, and he's like, "You hear that coming? Cleveland's coming." And let's just say that I was rooting so hard for a World Series win, if for no other reason than to shut up all the loud mouths that I had to deal with, not just from classmates, but from teachers as well. And my history teacher would later tell my parents during parent-teacher conferences that my grade slipped during the World Series. I regret nothing about that. That was the case. But that was my take about being a high school student in the western suburbs of Chicago and a White Sox fan, in which I had to deal with Cubs fans on a regular basis. But let's hear from Mike's perspective on the postseason leading up to the World Series.
Again, it was surreal. I wasn't there when they clinched. Unfortunately, we didn't get to experience any of the clinching celebrations because they clinched on the road for everything. From the division, they clinched at, I believe, in Detroit. And then the divisional series, they clinched that in Boston. Angels clinched that in Anaheim. So we weren't a part of the celebration, per se. But I just remember my first game out in the field was to drop third strike because they're superstitious, the team. So how they choose the bat boy, you keep going till you lose. So Bafia, he was seniority. So he started the playoffs. So he pep boyed the two Boston games and the first Anaheim game, which they lost. So then they rotated to me. Mooney gave up his bat boy duties pretty early on. He was more behind the scenes, as was Tim Colletti. So pretty much Bafia and I alternated that whole season. So my first game was the drop third strike game. So right there, when they won that game, that was for sure a turn in the tide. And that's kind of my first thought, like, holy crap, like, this is it.
I don't have a lot of room to talk, being that I would have been one of those obnoxious Cubs fans, because the athletic director at my high school and I'd had him as a teacher for a few things. I mean, we friendly banter butted heads over this, and I mean, I wasn't necessarily actively rooting. Okay, maybe I was a little bit during the initial rounds of the playoffs. By the time we got to the World Series, especially given the opponent, I kind of softened my stance on that a little bit. And part of that is because of who our National League combatant is.
Well, surprisingly, it's not the St. Louis Cardinals, although they did get to the NLCS for the second straight year. And in fact, I was rooting for the Cardinals kind of to make the World Series that year because my family had gone to St. Louis for the first time that summer. My dad and I took a few games in during the final season of the old Busch Stadium. So I was thinking, boy, this would be really cool. And I ended up getting on TV because of a Jim Edmonds wedge gem. But alas, it is the Houston Astros making their first ever appearance in the World Series, and it did not seem like they would get that far. They started 15-30, end up winning the National League wild card on the last day of the season against the Cubs, I remember. And they end up beating the Braves in a thrilling National League Division Series, an 18-inning walk-off home run by Chris Burke decided that series. And then they beat the Cardinals in six games, eliminating them in St. Louis, but not before Albert Pujols did Albert Pujols things in that NLCS. And normally I would not bring up a home run in the league championship series, but I think we have to because it winds up being very important later on.
Yeah, let's do it.
So Albert Pujols comes up to the plate when the Astros are one inning away from clinching their first pennant in game five. And Brad Lidge is on the mound, and Albert Pujols hits a ball that has not landed yet.
No, I'm pretty sure that has probably cleared the train tracks above the left field Crawford boxes probably, what, 3 or 4 times by now?
Something like that, but Roy Oswalt shuts down the Cardinals during the next game, and the Astros are going to the World Series. And it was kind of bittersweet for me because when I was 10 years old back in 1999, I had a question published in Sports Illustrated for Kids, and future Hall of Fame second baseman Craig Biggio was the athlete who answered my question. And later that summer, I had a chance to meet him when the Astros came to then named Comiskey Park during interleague play. So up until that point, I was so badly rooting for Craig to get into a World Series and to win a World Series. Of course, now he gets it, and it's against my White Sox. So I felt bad about having to root against him. But he played 2,564 regular season games before getting to his first and turned out only World Series. Jeff Bagwell, his teammate, had been with the Astros almost as long, 2,150 games. He would end up retiring after this World Series, and he was injured for much of the year, but he would serve his team well in kind of a limited role. The Astros had some fantastic pitching. We mentioned Brad Lidge, who up until Pujols hit that big home run was a lights-out closer. But Roger Clemens' retirement from 2003 turned out to be premature because he came back the next year with the Astros, is back again this year, and he ends up leading the National League in ERA with 1.87. And Andy Pettitte is back this time with the Astros, a 2.39 ERA. They had the top two ERAs in the National League. Roy Oswalt with a 2.94 ERA, ranked 7th, and won his 20th game for the second straight season. The bigger story, no disrespect to the Astros, is that 16,816 days had passed between when the White Sox lost their last World Series game to the Dodgers in 1959 up until Game 1 at U.S. Cellular Field for Game 1 of the 2005 series. And let's hear about the pageantry that Mike experienced.
We got to go out in the field for the ceremony, for the national anthem, everything like that. And again, I was so young and naive, like now looking back on it, and especially going through 4 more seasons and never getting to that, I wish I took it in more and kind of understood the scale of what was happening at the time. But like I said, I was just a 16-year-old kid that first year, just ecstatic to get a job that I had and then to get to where I was. I mean, it was experiences of a lifetime all rolled into such a small time frame. So it was really tough to kind of just keep up and really in the moment realize how awesome it was.
So after all of this buildup, we finally get into some action. We get a lot of offense early on. With 2 outs in the first inning, Jermaine Dye hits a solo home run to right field after a very good at-bat against Roger Clemens. That was a 9-pitch at-bat, and that could play a part later on. And then with 1 out in the top of the second, Mike Lamb hits a game-tying solo home run to center with 1 out. The White Sox score twice on 3 hits in the second, and then Morgan Ensberg hits a 2-run game-tying double of 2 outs in the third inning. And that turns out to be it for Roger Clemens after only 54 pitches over 2 innings. He gave up 3 runs on 4 hits before being relieved by Wandy Rodriguez. And honestly, maybe it's a good thing that Phil Garner decided that he wouldn't come back out if it wasn't Clemens' decision, because I have a feeling that if he had stayed out there, he would have gotten absolutely lit up.
Entirely possible, given how well the White Sox were doing. I mean, Clemens got through the first, you know, other than the home run by Dye, you know, seemed like he had things under control, had a few ground outs, but then, yeah, got hit around a little bit. Carl Everett and Aaron Rowan with back-to-back singles leading off the bottom of the second. Pierzynski with a RBI fielder's choice. He would come around to score on a Juan Uribe RBI double. Lance Berkman obviously tying the game in the top half of the third. The way that the White Sox were looking one time through the lineup and now getting a second go-around, it's probably good that they go to Wandy Rodriguez, who himself runs into a little bit of trouble in the bottom of the third, but gets through it.
He does get through it, but then in the fourth inning with 1 out, Joe Crede hits a solo home run to left center that gives the Sox a 4-3 lead. And then Joe Crede does Joe Crede things with his glove. Willie Taveras doubles to lead off the sixth. He moves to third on a Lance Berkman ground out to first, but he ends up stranded after Morgan Ensberg grounds out to third on a really nice play by Crede, and then Lamb grounds out to second to end that inning. And then the seventh inning, Bagwell, whom, as I mentioned, is participating in the series in a limited role. He can DH in American League Ballpark in 2005. He gets hit by a pitch. He moves to second when Auspice is hit by a pitch. He moves to third when Auspice is forced out on a ground ball, but he fails to score when Crede makes another nice play, this time on Biggio. And as Ed Farmer says, hang a star on that. That was one of his trademark calls. And keep in mind, Cree is displaying this Brooks Robinson-esque defense with a back injury, and a back injury that would plague him throughout his career. So the fact that he actually got down and made these plays, nothing short of impressive.
No gold gloves in the career for Joe Creedy, but a couple of absolute web gems at a time when his team absolutely needed them.
And then in the eighth inning, Willie Taveras doubles to lead it off. Jose Contreras comes out of the game for Neil Kotz. That is the first time that a White Sox reliever has made an appearance since game one of the ALCS 11 days earlier. Coincidentally, that was also Neil Kotz in two-thirds of an inning. But the fact that Contreras has gotten this far is nothing short of impressive. But then again, it's second nature to the White Sox and their fans at this point. Kotz runs into some trouble at first. Lance Berkman singles to move Taveras to third, but then Kotz has back-to-back strikeouts of Ensberg and Lamb. And then comes in big, bad Bobby Jenks. He began the season with Double-A Birmingham. Jeff Bagwell is the batter, and Ozzie Guillen makes the sign that would follow Jenks throughout the rest of his time with the White Sox. Give me the wide, tall guys, Joe Buck says. Waves his arms out and then shifts them. Is the big indicator that the big guy is coming in. And keep in mind, the third closure the White Sox have had this year. It started with Shingo Takatsu, then he starts struggling. Justin Hermanson was the closer for most of the year, but then Bobby Jenks comes up, and he just blows everybody away. And as Don Cooper says, the biggest monster of the Midway, Don Cooper, the pitching coach for the White Sox. And true to form, he strikes out Jeff Bagwell in a clutch situation. So, I mean, there had to be a big confidence boost for him. Striking out a future Hall of Famer, what better?
Yeah, absolutely. And 6'4", 275, the measurements for one big bad Bobby Jenks. So, yeah, the wide, tall guy motion that Ozzie Guillen made, totally fitting.
A.J. Pierzynski leads off the eighth inning with a single. He later steals second. Yes, he steals second. And he scores on a Scott Podsednik RBI triple. So the White Sox have an insurance run, and that is enough for Bobby Jenks to strike out two of the three hitters he faces in the ninth inning for the save. The White Sox take game one, 5-3.
Yeah, huge win to get in front of your home crowd there to open things up. Nice job getting the bullpen back out there after not having needed them for a week and a half. And so far, so good.
So we get to game two, which has cold and rainy conditions. It's also notable for the fact that it is the final public appearance of Chicago native Lou Rawls, who sings the national anthem only a couple of months before he passed away. So I'm glad that he was able to experience that while he's still on this mortal coil. Mark Burley is the first pitcher to start an All-Star game and a World Series game the same year since Clemens and Randy Johnson both did in 2001. And he is going up against the most seasoned postseason pitcher of all time, Andy Pettitte, his eighth postseason game two start, his record 34th postseason start overall. Morgan Ensberg leads off the second with a home run to left. The Astros have their first lead of the series. Then Aaron Rowan singles with one out in the second. He moves to second after tagging up on a ball that Pierzynski hits off the left field wall, and they cost the White Sox extra bases. And to be fair, Rowan thinks the ball is going to be caught. And yes, Pierzynski should have a double, but for Rowan tagging up. But Joe Creedy is hitting .571 with runners in scoring position up to this point. And he promptly drives in Rowan on RBI single. And then Craig Biggio drops a Juan Uribe pop-up to second base. And Creedy ends up being forced out on a .496 play, you know, a typical relay in any baseball game. Pierzynski scores the go-ahead run. And then with one out to the third inning, Taveras triples. He promptly scores on Berkman's sack fly. Then Ausmus doubles to lead off the fifth inning. He moves to third on Taveras infield single, and both of them score on a Berkman RBI double. So the White Sox are in their first real jam of this World Series. And then we get to the seventh inning. Juan Uribe doubles with one out. He moves to second on a Tadahito Gucci walk. And then Jermaine Dye works the count full, and he sees a ball on the seventh pitch of the at-bat that appears to hit him, and home plate umpire Jeff Nelson tells him to go to first base, although replays show that this pitch from Dan Wheeler, who had relieved Pett to begin the seventh inning, actually hit the barrel of Dye's bat. Fox ended up making this a much bigger deal than it probably should have because of what's coming. But let's be honest. One, even today, that is a judgment called by the umpires and could not be reviewed by a replay. And the other thing is, even if the ball had somehow missed the barrel of the bat, it was ball four anyway. I'm not trying to make excuses for the missed call by Jeff Nelson, but let's be honest, that ball was nowhere near the strike zone. So even if he had somehow dropped the bat, it was going to probably make some sort of contact with Dye's body, if not the air. So you can make all the controversy about this thing you want, but let's be honest, that was nowhere near a strike anyway.
It's entirely true. I have no qualms with the whole fact that it was ruled a hit by pitch. Like you said, I mean, it was clearly up and in. It would have been ball four regardless, so that is it for reliever Dan Wheeler. Chad Qualls comes in, and he is immediately greeted by the captain.
You know, there are moments in a sports fan's life when something happens, and it happens once, maybe twice, maybe three times in your lifetime, when you realize you have reached the mountaintop. Maybe you have not reached the ultimate goal, but you realize that this is for real. This is great. You are at the very top of everything, and there's no coming back down from this. Paul Konerko, the captain, who, by the way, is in a contract year, greets Chad Qualls with a swing off first pitch fastball. And to quote the late great Ed Farmer, whose words have all but been injected into my veins, swing a long one to left. It's going to go. It's a slam. Sox lead. 6-4. Light it up. I don't think U.S. Cellular Field, as it was known then, has been that loud ever since then. Maybe not even as loud as any crowd at the old Comiskey Park. And I don't think any fandom has ever exploded as collectively, at least as far as the Southside fandom is concerned.
Something about grand slams in Chicago in playoff games that just seems to go well. We'll have, I mean, not in a World Series, but we'll have another one that is near and dear to my heart in very similar descriptive terms coming up in a future episode, but for now, the White Sox have completely turned this game on its head. They have seized control. Mark Burley has done what he needed to do over the course of 7 innings. He kept the Sox in the game until Paul Konerko could do what he does. Off to the bullpen.
The 8th inning goes off without a hitch. Ozzie Guillen gets Bobby Jenks on the phone, as we see in the World Series film, to instill confidence in his young closer. Bobby Jenks does, in fact, enter in the 9th inning, but it's not so clean this time. He gives up a leadoff single to Bagwell and a walk to Chris Burke. Both runners advance on a Brad Auspice groundout to first. And then Jose Vizcaino, no stranger to World Series heroics, as Michael Clark Duncan says in the World Series film, as we know from when he walked off Game 1 of the 2000 World Series, and the World Series film flashes back to that as well. He pinch hits for Adam Everett, and all analysis says he is a good fastball hitter. And sure enough, Bobby Jenks throws a fastball away, and he loops it to left field. Bagwell scores, and then Burke comes in on play at the plate. He is ruled safe, and his hand clearly gets in their head of the play. The game is tied, and even to this day, whenever I watch that replay, I hope that this time, just like when I hope the Titanic misses the iceberg in the movie, that this time Brzezinski tags Burke in time, but not to be. So Jenks is out of the game. Neil Kotz comes in, and Bobby Jenks is inconsolable at this point. But as we see on the World Series film, Mark Burley, who has lost his chance at a World Series win because of this play, is giving him a hug, saying, hey, it's okay. And then A.J. Brzezinski says, while he is still on the mound during the pitching change, now we're just going to walk him off. Come on, break their hearts twice. Speaking of which, Brad Lidge is on the mound for the Astros, and he gets Juan Uribe with the first out. And as Scott Pitsenik is at the plate working a 2-1 count, Joe Buck questions Tim McCarver on the Fox broadcast, do you think that maybe in Game 6 of the NLCS, Phil Gardner should have brought Lidge in to get the taste of the Pujols home run out of his mouth? To which McCarver says, I don't think that taste is there.
Oh, Tim McCarver, when will you learn? When will you learn?
So Scott Podsednik, who had no home runs during the regular season, his first home run of the playoffs, game one of the ALDS, when he hit a three-run bomb, he hits a ball that I think is going for extra bases because, you know, first of all, he's not a power hitter. But I'm thinking, okay, this is great. He's at least got to second base. There's going to be good speed aboard for Tadahito Oguchi and, if needed, Jermaine Dye. And hopefully he doesn't get back to Canerco. But, you know, if it happens, it happens. But I'll just let John Rooney say, Podsednik hits a drive. Deep right center field. This is way back in the gap. And it's a goner. A White Sox winner. A winner on Podsednik home run. And the Sox go up 2-0 in the 2005 World Series. Like I said, I thought it was just going to be an extra base hit, but then I saw that the Fox camera kept zooming in on the right center field seats. I'm like, no way. Is he really going to do it? And then I see the ball land, and I must have said, oh my God, at least 15 times in a row, because as Scott Podsednik says on the World Series film, I think everybody was shocked that ball came off of my bat. And from an outsider's perspective, Lucas, I wonder if even the biggest White Sox haters among Cubdom were thinking, okay, this is it. There's no way they're losing this World Series now.
I mean, at this point, with the way they've been going, and the World Series film, too, talked about this a little bit with the Astros and heartbreak, and we saw it with the Pujols home run in Game 5 a little bit, which, you know, kind of foreshadowing Brad Lidge now. Giving up a big home run to Albert Pujols, okay, yeah, he does that to people a lot. Giving it up to Scott Podsednik, of all people, is just when your leadoff hitter who has no home runs during the regular season and for his entire major league career hit 42 home runs in regular season play. And then when you factor in the playoffs, you know, he had the one earlier in the postseason. So he's hit 44 home runs as a major leaguer counting the playoffs. Beware the little guy.
The last World Series walk-off home run was actually not that long ago. Alex Gonzalez homered off Jeff Weaver during the 2003 World Series. You remember we talked about that. That was in Game 4 during the original Roger Clemens farewell game. But as we have already established in this episode, blatant lies. Mm-hmm. And let's go back to Mike and his perspective. And believe it or not, you can actually see him celebrate with Canerco after his grand slam. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's let him give his side.
That was, again, just a top memory of my lifetime. That was really cool. I remember it was raining a little bit. I remember being on the field with Ozzie, he fat boy with me. He's Ozzie's youngest kid. And I've mentioned this somewhere else. I can't remember where, but Ozzie called it. He said, "Kirk goes 1 yard here." And it was the first pitch, and I just remember both of us jumping out of our seats and just couldn't believe it. Absolutely could not believe it. I remember Bobby blowing the lead, and I remember he had a little bit of a blow-up, and I remember him going to the bat room and breaking a few bats and doing a little damage. He was upset. And then Scotty came up in the bottom of the ninth, and, well, you know the rest. Those two moments right there were crazy. And I remember I was the first person, aside from, I believe, first non-player at least, to get to high-five Canerco after that grand slam. And the coolest gift I've ever gotten in my entire life, my parents were able to find, they contacted the Sun-Times, just I can't remember the trib, and they got this really cool picture of me holding Canerco's bat, just smile, grinning ear to ear, and with my other right hand up, get ready to give Paulie a fist bump, and he's got his hand up too. So you see me just smiling ear to ear, and you see the back of Canerco's jersey. And then in the background, you probably remember the famous elderly woman with the, "I waited 92 years for this." You can see her in the background. So that's hanging up in my parents' basement still. It's a giant, huge framed picture of that moment. Yeah, that one I'm going to remember forever.
So we go to Texas, the very first World Series game ever played in Texas, which is crazy now given all the World Series that happened after this. Mm-hmm. But in any event, Jeff Blum, who has been a forgotten man of this White Sox roster, is shown the World Series film mic'd up and taking batting practice off of the late batting practice pitcher Kevin Hickey. And he laments his lack of playing time. He's like, "I've seen one pitch in 4 weeks." And in fact, his only playoff play appearance to this point was a first pitch pop out to second as a pinch hitter late in game one of that ALDS. And he is hoping that because it's the National League that he will get a chance to play. Craig Biggio doubles as he was prone to do during his career. He leads off the first inning with that. He later scores on a Berkman RBI single. Berkman, clearly the best hitter that the Astros have right now. Then Adam Everett leads off the third with a single. He later scores on an RBI single by Biggio. So Biggio is giving and receiving. He scores later on Ensberg RBI single. And then we get a controversial home run call that goes the Astros' way. Jason Lane leads off the fourth with a home run to left center. But because Minute Maid Park has such a goofy layout, the ball actually hits off the top of the wall. And the ground rules of Minute Maid Park dictated that if a ball landed on the right side of this L-shaped yellow line in left center, that it would have been ruled a home run. But it actually landed to the left, and umpire Gary Cederstrom gave the home run wave. And if this had taken place a few years later, that home run is definitely being reviewed, but there's no replay review in 2005. So as it stands, the Astros are up 4-0. And as long as we're on the subject of Minute Maid Park being goofy, I remember going into the World Series games in Houston, the Astros and their fans were complaining about the fact that Major League Baseball was making their roof stay open because there was no threat of inclement weather. But they're like, oh, but we've had the roof closed the entire season. That gives us our home field advantage. And the White Sox had their home field advantage with the cold and rain weather in Chicago. And grow up already. Baseball is meant to be played outdoors. And I know that we'll be seeing this be completely flipped in future episodes of this podcast, but if nothing else, this established that there are quite a few crybabies for the fan base representing Houston as well as the team representing that city.
Fair. Let's also take a moment to point out that of the umpiring crew, Gary Cederstrom was the one who made the home run call, and not two other names that are on this list who we all know and loathe: Angel Hernandez and Country Joe West. The fact that Hawk Harrelson was not calling these games is probably for the best, because his head would have exploded 50 times over.
But the fortunate thing about this is that neither man made a consequential call during this entire series. I'll just get that out of the way
true,
right now.
True. Let's give credit where credit is due.
So the Astros are up 4-0. And then the fifth inning, the wheels start to come off for Rory Oswalt. Preedy leaves off the fifth with a solo home run to right. One Uribe singles. He moves to second on a Pasenik single. Both score on back-to-back RBI singles by Iguchi and Dye. Canerco flies out to center for the second out of the inning. Then Pruszynski scores Iguchi and Dye an RBI double to center. Not all the way to, but towards that hill that used to be in center field at Minute Maid Park. So the White Sox have a 5-4 lead. If that was a hitter's ballpark, that would have been a 3-run home run by Pruszynski. But he will definitely take a 2 RBI double. White Sox end up sending 11 men to the plate that inning, scoring 5 runs on 6 hits. Oswalt throws 46 pitches, and Oswalt comes out of the game after Canerco leads off the 7th, and he walks on 4 pitches. Russ Springer relieves him. And as Paul Canerco says in the World Series film, Oswalt does his best when guys take, and you have to be aggressive at him. And that 5th inning especially, the White Sox exposed Roy Oswalt to a T.
Going through pitch counts of having to attack him, you know, Joe Creedy's home run came on an 0-1 pitch. Juan Uribe singled on 5 pitches. John Garland hitting for himself, obviously not hitting pitchers forever in this particular instance. He strikes up, but he does make Oswalt work a little bit, takes 6 pitches there. Scotty Pods, a single on a 1-1 pitch. Iguchi, same thing. Now, Jermaine Dye ends up working the count. On the 8th pitch of the at-bat is when he drives home Pasenik to make it a 4-3 ball game. Canerco goes 0-1 on the flyout, and then Pierzynski, second pitch, is the one that he drives all the way out to center. So, I mean, by and large, yeah, to your point, they're attacking Roy Oswalt, and they're jumping all over him here in this 5th inning.
Also keep in mind that Jermaine Dye is really working counts in this World Series. There was that 9th pitch at-bat to hit home run game 1. He has a 7-pitch at-bat before the hit-by pitch in Game 2, and now an 8-pitch at-bat here. And he is really increasing the number of pitches per play appearance that he had during the regular season. And just spoiler alert right now, it will end up being a 20% increase from his regular season number, 4.78 pitches per plate appearance. The Astros are obviously in trouble. Auspice walks to lead off the bottom of the 7th. He moves to second on a sack bunt by Adam Everett, but John Garland induces a pop out by Bagwell, who is pinch hitting for Springer, and he strikes out Biggio to end his 9, which gives up 2 earned runs, strikes out 4, walks 2, so a nice outing for him. Ensberg and Lamb then have back-to-back walks with 2 outs in the 8th inning, so Dustin Hermanson relieves Neil Kott. Kott only faced 1 batter. This is Hermanson's first appearance since September 30th during that Cleveland series to end the regular season that I mentioned. And whether it was rust or whatever, Jason Lane scores Ensberg on a game-tying RBI double. But Hermanson, to his credit, rebounds nicely. He strands the go-ahead run at third by striking out Osmus. And then in the ninth inning, Orlando Hernandez walks the bases loaded, including an intentional walk to Berkman with two outs, but he strikes out Ensberg to send the game to extra innings. And unlike back in Game 3 of the ALDS, when he got all the bases loaded, nobody out jammed in a one-run game against the Red Sox, he cleaned up his own mess this time. So we go to extras. And Jeff Blum, we talked about him earlier. When it got to the top of the 13th, after Todd Higuchi made the last out, Ginn ends up double-switching down with Solmarte to Higuchi's second spot. And as he gained start to write Pablo Ozuna's name on his lap card, but then as he was going up to give the lap changes to Jerry Lane, the home plate umpire, he sees Blum standing in the corner, and he recalls that Harold Baines, his bench coach, suggested a few innings earlier that Blum, who was a switch hitter, who is better hitting from the left side, would be a better fit to lay in the game because Wandy Rodriguez was the only lefty left in the Astros bullpen at that point. So instead of Ozuna, he has Blum come in to play second base. And that move ends up paying off with two outs in the 14th inning because the first RBI for him since the first game of a doubleheader August 30th against the Rangers comes in the form of a go-ahead solo shot, and that comes off of Ezequiel Estacio. The White Sox have the lead off of the bat of another unlikely power source in Jeff Blum, who was the only trade deadline acquisition for the Sox from San Diego, while others were saying, well, they should have gotten better. Well, it turned out that my namesake was really all that they needed. And he was also a former Astro, so people were probably stunned at that point. Of course, now he is the color commentator for the Astros on their TV broadcast, but nobody cared about that at that point. Interestingly enough, right before he hit that home run, Tim McCarver says on the broadcast, in the time it's taken to play this game, you could have flown from Baltimore to Iceland. And the graphic shows up saying, as Joe Buck reads off, you can fly from New York to L.A., cook a turkey for Thanksgiving, you can watch 20% of a season of 24, so a little network promotion right there, or watch the longest game in World Series history. We'll get more into that in a bit. But the White Sox add insurance run the top of the 14th. And then in the bottom half, Orlando Palmeiro walks with one out. He moves to second on defensive indifference, and he reaches third on a one rebate error. And then Mark Burley comes into the game for his first relief appearance since his rookie year. Game 2 of the 2000 ALDS was his last relief appearance. And it was not known for many years, but he was a couple of beers deep when he came into this game. But that did not stop him from approaching Don Cooper, asking if he should put his spikes on. And Cooper's like, well, if it gets to lengthy extra innings, we might need you then. And of course, it turned out like that. So, buzz, drunk, whatever. Burley comes into this game and induces a pop-out to short from Adam Everett for a World Series save. So he doesn't get a World Series win, but he gets a World Series save. The White Sox win the longest game in World Series history, 7-5, 5 hours and 41 minutes, tied for the longest by innings 14 with Game 2 of the 1916 series. That game, by the way, was played in 2 hours and 32 minutes, which definitely speaks to how media has altered the pace of play in baseball. But that's a topic for another day. In any event, the White Sox are one win away.
Going back real quick to the time thing, like I remember seeing, it was 2015. I went to a 12-inning game at Wrigley that lasted like 5 hours, and my wife was wanting it to be done for basically half of that. And I also went to a 12-inning game for the Kane County Cougars that took half of that. But Jeff Blum adds his name to an illustrious list of guys who have homered in their first World Series plate appearance. And Mark Burley, after having started and gone 7 innings in Game 2 just a couple days prior, comes back, needs just 3 pitches to record the save, and the White Sox have a stranglehold on the series.
The game ended at 1:20 a.m. After 482 pitches, 341 minutes, 43 players, 17 pitchers, and, of course, we mentioned the 14 innings. So a lot of baseball, and it is finally over. We go to Game 4, which has its first pitch 18 hours and 21 minutes after Game 3 ends, but not before. We have another ceremony before a World Series game. We've had a few of them in recent episodes. Mm-hmm. We had the All-Century team in the 99 series. In 2002, we had the 10 most memorable moments in baseball history. This time is a Latino Legends team. At this point, Latinos have had enough of an impact on the game that they decided the fans needed to vote. And there were a few people missing at this game because there were hurricanes going at the time, so they had to be back home to deal with that. But still a lot of baseball royalty was here. Fernando Valenzuela, Juan Marichal, Rod Carew, Pedro and Edgar Martinez, Ivan Pudge Rodriguez, who we remember for a couple episodes back. Alex Rodriguez is here. Roberto Clemente is represented by his family. And as the World Series film points out, it's a special moment for Ozzie Guillen, a Venezuelan native who is trying to become the first Hispanic manager to win a World Series.
At this point, the script just writes itself, doesn't it? It's not a certain thing, though, at first, because the White Sox Freddy Garcia and Houston starter Brandon Backey go 0-for-0 for the first 7 innings.
Well, let's dive a little deeper into that, shall we?
Sure.
Freddy Garcia was part of the Astros trade to the Mariners for Randy Johnson while he was a prospect during the 1998 deadline. Backey, meanwhile, was acquired from the Devil Rays for Blum in December 2003. So the Astros have to deal with the past possibly coming back to haunt them. We'll see. Lamb leads off the second with a double, but he is stranded there. And in fact, that's part of a trend in which the Astros leadoff hitter reaches base in 4 of the first 5 innings, but nobody scores. Not to be outdone, Brandon Backey strikes out 5 straight hitters between the 4th and 5th innings. And as you mentioned, the White Sox and Astros are not scoring at all. Probably the biggest threat that the Astros get is in the 6th inning. Tavares singles with 1 out. He moves to 2nd on a Berkman walk. Both execute a steal on Ensberg's strikeout. Lamb is intentionally walked to load the bases, but then Garcia gets Lane to strike out. The White Sox get a threat to the 7th inning. Rowan singles with 2 outs. He moves to 3rd on a Creedy double, but he's stranded on a Uribe strikeout. Backey ends up throwing 7 shutout innings, walks nobody, gives up 5 hits, 7 strikeouts as well. Not to be outdone, Freddy Garcia pitches a perfect 7th inning. He has 7 shutout innings, and he strikes out 7, gives up 4 hits and 3 walks. And if you look at the game score for these guys, the box score, virtually even. So as we go into the 8th inning, nobody knows how this game is going to play out, but look who's coming in for the Astros because the pitcher spot is up for the Astros in the 7th inning.
Yeah, so Jeff Bagwell had pinch hit for Backey in the bottom of the 7th. Garcia got him to ground out. At this point, because of that, having to get him out, you've got to go to the bullpen. And tie game, okay, yeah, I guess I don't have an issue with Brad Lidge coming in. And Lidge had pitched a little bit in Game 3 and had been able to get through it without too much of an issue. Now, we have the pitcher spot again due up here for the White Sox, too. Again, National League Park, so in steps Willie Harris.
And that was also part of a double switch. And he leads the 8th inning off with a base hit on a 2-2 fastball. He moves to 2nd when Pasenik has a sack bunt. And Carl Everett, who is pinch hitting for Gucci, grounds out to 2nd when the process moves Harris over to 3rd. And then a 1-1 count, Jermaine Dye has an RBI single. Harris scores as his 7th hit of the series. That is Harris's first run since he scored twice September 15th against the Royals. So we finally get a run. And keep in mind, the White Sox won their first game of the season 1-0. They won their first game after the All-Star break 1-0. Think the Stars are starting to align here?
Maybe a little bit.
So the White Sox still have to get 6 outs in order to reach that elusive World Series championship. Tavares is hit by a pitch with 1 out in the 8th inning. He moves to 2nd on a wild pitch. He moves to 3rd on an Ensberg flyout, but is stranded when Jose Vizcaino pinch hitting for Lamb grounds out to short. So Lamb does not strike twice for Jose Vizcaino in this World Series. So in the 1-0 game, the only thing to do in the bottom of the 9th is bring in Bobby Jenks for Neil Kotz. Jason Lane has a leadoff single. That's the Astros' 4th leadoff hit of the game. Then Ausmus moves Lane to 2nd on a sack bunt. And I know some people were probably mad because Phil Garter is giving away outs in an elimination game in the 9th inning, a 1-run game. But as a White Sox fan, I'm not caring about that. And then Chris Burke is pinch hitting for Adam Everett, and he hits a ball towards foul ground between third base and left field. And Joe Creed and Juan Uribe, the left side of the infield, are both going for this ball. And Uribe dives into the stands, which you can't do now because of the protective netting. But in 2005, that's not a thing. So he dives into the crowd. And nobody knows if he has caught the ball, but it soon becomes very obvious that the ball, in fact, landed in his glove. And while the biggest defensive plays in World Series history, and obviously one of the biggest defensive plays in Chicago baseball history, takes place on what some would say is an anti-Steve Bartman play.
I mean, it is kind of in the neighborhood, accounting for differences in ballpark of where that was. And, you know, I think of like the Derek Jeter flying into the stands. I mean, this was kind of reminiscent of it. And if there was any doubt prior to this pop fly, you would have to say it's pretty much a formality by now, right?
Orlando Palmeiro is pinch hitting for Brad Lidge. And once the count reaches 1-2, AJ Pierzynski calls a curveball. And then we have the fouling call by the legendary John Rudy, and what turns out to be his final broadcast for the White Sox before he moves over to St. Louis to call the Cardinals. He says, "Here's the 1-2 pitch to Palmeiro. A ground ball past Jenks up the middle of the infield. Uribe has it. He throws. Out! Out! A White Sox winner and a world championship. The White Sox have won the World Series, and they're mobbing each other on the field." And Ed Farmer adds, "This was a great ball game tonight. This is as good as it gets. The Sox are world champions in Chicago. Go crazy."
We talked a lot in last week's episode about the Red Sox and the 86-year drought that they snapped. And the White Sox had, as we mentioned, you know, they had won the World Series the year prior. So add on a year, this is 88 years of frustration and futility. And it's completely wiped away with that bouncer over the head of Jenks that Uribe gets to just in time to Paul Konerko. And like you said, go crazy.
And I did not react to this until Gary Cederstrom made that final out call, because it was a bang-bang play at first base. So Cederstrom, who made a bad home run call in Game 3, makes the right call to end the World Series. And by the way, this is all happening in front of former President George Herbert Walker Bush and his wife Barbara. And they are rooting for the Astros in the front row. And they have to endure the sight of the White Sox celebrating their first world championship in 88 years. Collectively, between the Red Sox and the White Sox, 63,554 days passed, 174 years. The White Sox end up winning 8 straight to end the postseason, just like the Red Sox did the year before. But it was actually part of a 16-1 stretch to end the season going back to the regular season. They lost only one game over the final 29 days. Only the 1970 Orioles, besides this White Sox team, finished 18-1, had won a world championship by winning 16 of its last 17 games. They did this by holding the Astros at bay over the final 15 innings, not allowing them to score at all. Just goes to show you how dominant that pitching was. They are the fifth wire-to-wire champion, and they were also the second World Series champion to have no 300-hitter or 20-game winner, joining the 97 Marlins. And they became the first team to sweep the World Series while winning every game by one or two runs. And their six-run advantage over the four games tied the 1950 Yankees for the thinnest margin in a World Series sweep. And they joined the 1962 Yankees as the only team to win the World Series by winning a 1-0 game on the road. The 20th time, including the playoffs, that the White Sox won by one on the road. Only those 1970 Orioles, who won 108 games, had more than 22. And it's just crazy to think how, for all the disrespect that this world championship team gets, ESPN, CBS, for getting them in recent years, and that is not the only disrespect they had, they deserve to be remembered a lot more. And yeah, I remember the immediate aftermath saying, oh, the TV ratings were the lowest ever. But obviously since then, World Series ratings have continued to plummet, so it looks pretty good now in comparison. This might have been a one-year wonder, but it was a team that dominated every stretch of the way. And that 11-1 record tied the 99 Yankees for the best playoff record in the three-round era, which is still really young at this point. Also, the second straight World Series sweep, the last time that happened was with the 98 and 99 Yankees. And dominance, again, does not begin to describe this team. In fact, it is at the very top of the list of superlatives you can use to describe this 05 White Sox team.
Yeah, I mean, that run is one of the memorable ones. You know, you mentioned the fact that they only lost the one postseason game, matching the 99 Yankees for the most successful in the three-round era. And, I mean, it wasn't necessarily just the fact that they went 11-1 over the 12 playoff games they played. It was the way they did it, too. We talked so much during that Yankee dynasty about do not give them an opportunity, they will kill you. And we saw this happen time and time and time again during the 05 White Sox run.
Paul Konerko said it best, we're the perfect example of why you don't need to put together an all-star team to win a championship. You just have to peak at the right time. And it's very true. A lot of these guys end up having career years. Jermaine Dye is your World Series MVP. For years, I thought that Joe Crean should have gotten it, but looking back at the numbers years later, and given the fact that he worked those at-bats so well, like we mentioned earlier, I think in the end, he was the one who indeed deserved that hardware.
Yeah, I agree. So the final lines, just as a point of comparison, Jermaine Dye slashing 438, 526, 688 for a 1214 OPS. He had one home run, drove in three. I can kind of see the argument for Creedy in the fact that he had two home runs, drove in three. He slashed, though, 294, 368, 706, which, yes, phenomenal, but only a 1074 OPS as opposed to the 1214 posted by Jermaine Dye. Paul Konerko had the big grand slam. He finishes with a 250, 368, 500 slash line. Other notable guys, Scott Podsednik, 286, 286, 619. He had the walk-off home run in game two. AJ Pierzynski hit 267, drove in three runs. It was a team effort. I mean, and they had mentioned on the World Series film too, of like, it's a different hero, everybody stepping up at any given time. And, you know, all of those guys did it. We go back to the pitching again too. The Sox over the four game sweep post a team ERA of 2.63. Mark Burley, his a little bit higher, 4.91. I mean, he got hit a little bit, but recorded the save in game three. Jose Contreras, 1-0 with 386. Freddy Garcia, the 7 innings of shutout ball for his victory. Damaso Marte getting one of the other wins. Neil Kotz, over 4 relief appearances, goes 1 1/3, does not allow a run, has a victory as well. Dustin Hermanson and Orlando Hernandez in a combined inning and a third, also not allowing an earned run. Cliff Polite, 386, not the best, but on the whole, this pitching staff did what it needed to do, and they did what they did all year.
Bobby Jenks, by the way, becomes the first rookie to save a World Series clincher. He won't even exceed his rookie limits until 2006, so pretty good start to his major league career. The White Sox were very patient with this Astros pitching staff. When the Astros were meeting with their pitchers and catchers and their coaches and their scouts before this World Series, the consensus was that their pitchers had the edge because they decided that they were a free swinging bunch because only three teams in the American League had walked fewer times that year. Konerko, who had 81 walks, was the only hitter who had more than 50 walks. And the Astros, meanwhile, had struck out more batters than anyone in the NL besides the Cubs and the Brewers. The White Sox, however, draw 15 walks in that World Series. They averaged 2.7 per game during the regular season, so that's an increase. And the Astros were not able to counter that. In fact, they did not score their last 20 runners on base, and they went 0-for-31 on base during that time. As Tom Verducci writes in Sports Illustrated, a cumulative no-hitter and then some.
Indeed.
But take away all of the statistical advantages that the White Sox ended up having and why they won this World Series, and you still have, just like the Red Sox from the season before, a fan base that missed out on so much over the years, and finally, it's happened. Jerry Reinsdorf said that one of his favorite quotes from somebody was, "My father died 15 minutes after the White Sox won the World Series, but he died happy." And Konerko would tell Jason Stark when he was working for ESPN, "I've been here for 7 years, and on this team I've been here the longest, along with Frank Thomas. But compared with all the fans and all the people who put up with the frustrations of this team for all those years, that's nothing. Those are the people who have suffered for a long, long time. But when you win, people don't forget you. So now we'll always be remembered as part of the team that finally jumped over that wall." And true to form, the World Series parade that followed, that featured somewhere between 1.75 million and 2 million fans in Chicago, was absolutely incredible because I was there, I know this, and actually I had to be talked into it by my dad into missing school. And actually, I had never mentioned this, I actually went to bed during game three because I was so worried about not getting enough sleep before school the next day. I did not know until the next morning that Jeff Blum had hit that home run.
So, in fact, all the good stuff I had for those Houston games happened on the same day, October 26th, 2005, culminating in the final out recorded at 11:01 p.m. But I was just in the big crowd in Chicago on that Friday afternoon. So why don't we hear from somebody who was actually in the parade? Mike?
I think the coolest moment when like kind of all really settled in was during the parade. We almost didn't get to go on that parade. I remember showing up to work that day. We had to work that day, and we were all talking, if are we going to be on the, you know, the buses? We had no idea, and I don't remember last second. We got lucky, we got to go on. So I was on the bus with Joe Creedy and Aaron Rowan, and I believe Ed Farmer was also on that bus. I get to fact check me on that last, but I know Rowan and Creedy for sure. So that was when like it for sure set in, because that was before, at least to my knowledge, I was still, again, a 16-year-old kid. I didn't understand the whole notion and idea of like a championship parade at that point. You know, now every team has it, and they're, you know, televised. But so I had no idea what to expect during that parade. And I remember it started off kind of as a lull. We just saw some construction workers, that kind of stuff. But then we got towards the, you know, the inner city, the main part of it, and just seeing crowds. I've never seen a crowd like that in my life, at least from that perspective. So that was like the first time it for sure like set in, like, holy crap, this is it.
And when I asked Mike to sum up what he thought about this particular team, he gave quite a bit of insight into how that clubhouse operated. And given what he says here and what I know about this 2005 White Sox team, I'm not surprised.
Creedy and Rowan, those two guys were like two peas in a pod. We had a lot of tight relationships on that team. You know, I was there 05 through 09, and you didn't, looking back, you compare the vibes and how the clubhouse gets together, you know, how they get along, all the players. And I mean, 05, it was great. 06 was good as well. They had fun. Like, I remember Kangaroo Court, they would do a lot of that. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Kangaroo Court, but it's just kind of like a mock trial. Like, I remember one year, I don't think this was in 2005, Juan Uribe got written up in Kangaroo Court because they turned a triple play, and he didn't realize they turned a triple play, and he threw the ball into the stands, and you're supposed to keep that stuff because they authenticated and everything like that. So, like, bonehead stuff like that. I remember Scotty Pods got written up one year for, like, picking his nose, and it was caught live on camera, like, several times in one game, something like that. So those were, like, the types of things that occurred a lot in 2005 on a regular occurrence on the homestands, where, like, 2007, that was just a mundane, boring year. It had a lot of call-ups, a lot of guys that no one knew who they were. And those were tough years to get through. But, like, 05, that was just fun. All those guys just got along so well. Like, it's like Creedy and Rowan for best buds. Burley and Garland, really close. I don't think I've ever met a nicer person in my life than Chris Widger. It's probably one of the names that people don't remember much, but I think he was probably my favorite player I've ever encountered with them. It always seemed to be backup catchers. They seem to be kind of the salt of the earth guys because they're usually like the last man on the roster, you know? Like Chris Widger's, yeah, Toby Hall, he's another good example. I'm not dogging on them for being backup catchers, but they were always just very, just good to us. Not that any player was not good to us, but they spent more time in a clubhouse because they would have to run down to the bullpen mid-game to start catching. So we just kind of got to know those guys a little bit better. But just some just quality people, not just ball players, but just quality people on that 05 team. You look at those guys, and they had career years, and it's cliche, but they say lightning in the bottle, and that's true, and I do think luck is a part of that. I do, but I don't think that it's the major part. I think it's the chemistry, and again, that sounds very cheesy and cliche, but everything just went well. Those guys, they worked hard. I mean, you couldn't have asked for a better manager, Isaac Ian. It was just the perfect fit for everybody, you know? Everyone played light-hearted, and they played hard, serious, probably totally accountable, but had fun. I mean, you can see how important culture is in chemistry. Look at the last few years with the White Sox. You know, everyone thought we were going to be stacking World Series on top of World Series with the crew we've had over the last few years. And, I mean, talk about just absolute just being miserable the last few years the White Sox have been in. I mean, just talk about the polar opposite of what it was in 2005.
So all these years later, we're coming up on 20 years in a couple of years from the time we are recording this. What is Mike's biggest takeaway about being part of a championship team?
I was a drop in the bucket at most on that team, so I don't want to say I had a role, but, you know, it was just the relationships I made from the players, and I already spoke of Mooney and Bafia and Timmy, you know, and just seeing the work ethic those guys had, whether it was, you know, the players or even the trainers. You know, those guys put in long hours. We put in long hours. I learned a hard work ethic. I think I had that going into that job, but the anything, it solidified it. I experienced so much in that 5+ years. But in terms of the 05, like I said, when I remember, it was the relationships with Mooney, those guys, and man, it was just a lot of fun.
And you know, with this podcast, nobody alive today remembers the early days of the World Series, so it's up to us to carry on the narratives that came from those early World Series. And likewise, after we're gone, it will be up to those who come after us to carry that narrative on. And Mike is going to be able to do that with his own family and his future family.
Cool things is that they have that monument out at gate 4, and they have the team picture on the back, so I'm on the monument in the back, so that's going to be there forever. So I'm looking forward. I have 3 kids, twin girls, Grace and Quinn, who are going to be 3 this summer, and a son, Jack, who's going to be 2. So I want to bring them some baseball games. We didn't go to any last year, but I'm looking forward to bringing them because we're starting to understand it. You know, basketball and football, we haven't watched much baseball yet because last year was so miserable. They're younger, so I'm looking forward to watching baseball with them. But yeah, I'm looking forward to bringing them there and seeing what their reaction is when they realize I was in uniform, and maybe lie to them and tell them I hit the game-winning Grand Slam and it wasn't Paul Konerko, and see how many years I can get away with that for, you know?
Boy, I really hope, given what he said there at the end, that his kids are not listening to this right now so they don't get wise to him too early.
Yeah, seriously. So I did have one question for you, given that you experienced this, and it's almost a bit of a spoiler to some degree, and maybe not the best question to ask, but it's one of those kind of a curiosity thing, being a fan of a team like this. So let's say you get a time machine. You are allowed to go back to 19 years ago today. So spring training, 2005. You tell 16-year-old you, the White Sox are winning the World Series this year. That is it. Again, spoiler alert. What is 16-year-old Yu's reaction?
Well, I actually forgot to mention this at the beginning. Before the season started, I read an editorial, I believe it was the Daily Herald, who I actually have been writing for football and basketball games this past year, and hopefully softball and baseball games in the spring. So, shameless plug there.
Fair.
But I remember that the lead editorial, and I forget who wrote it, basically indicated that the theme song for the White Sox in 2005 should be Don't Stop by Fleetwood Mac, as in Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow, Don't Stop, It'll Soon Be Here. Basically writing the White Sox off for that season. And that just really bothered me. And yes, I knew that they had lost some big names in Valentin Ordóñez and Lee from the prior season, but I did not appreciate them already being written off. Because up until that point, during my White Sox fandom, I think 3rd was the worst that they had finished in the American League Central. So the idea of them finishing anywhere below them was just unfathomable to me. Which, obviously, given the state of the White Sox now, it's not so unfathomable, but that's a topic for another day. You kind of heard Mike talk about it. But I was hoping that, you know, maybe they still can pull something off. So, given the fact that I've been a White Sox fan for a few years at that point, but I had not started following them seriously until a couple of years before this, I was thinking, you know, maybe something can happen this year. Maybe this year they finally get past the Twins in the American League Central, and then who knows what can happen after that. I don't want to say I necessarily would have believed that they would have gone to the World Series. I would have loved to have seen them go to the World Series. As the season went on, I was buying into the hype that they were going to win the World Series, even though nobody outside the fan base was giving the White Sox a chance. But if I had gone back to my 16-year-old self during spring training 2005 and said the White Sox were in the World Series, honestly, I probably would have gloated to everybody who was making fun of me at school, saying, you don't know what you don't know, or something to that effect. So me being an immature 16-year-old, I would have been all in saying, you know, say whatever you want, and you'll say the White Sox suck, that the Cubs are going to win the World Series next year or whatever. But I know what's going to happen. So honestly, I probably would have watched that entire season with a sense of entitlement. And I don't know if I necessarily would have said that I wouldn't have been bothered by everything, because people would still try to get under my skin. On one hand, it would have sucked because I always like to be surprised in these situations, because that's the beauty of life. You don't know what's going to bring. But sometimes you wonder how it's going to play out, as the late Jose Fernandez indicated, and as Vin Scully said during his final home broadcast for the Dodgers, if you're given a book with the story of your life, would you read the ending? And kind of similar to this is, if you were given a book with the story of your team's season, would you read the ending? And since this 2005 season, I have endured seasons of triumph, albeit far less triumphs than this season, and more often than not, seasons that meant absolute disgust and heartbreak, and at this point, just indifference, because like I said, the White Sox, as they are not in a good place right now. But knowing that they were going to win the World Series, it would have just vindicated everything that I had said. If they could just get everything together, they can win it all. And lo and behold, they did. And I'm glad that my dad got to see it. And it was kind of an emotional year for my dad, too. I should have mentioned this earlier, because my grandpa was in the hospital during this World Series. He would pass away a few months later. And he was kind of emotional during that time, because at the start of the year, my dad had broken his ankle, so he couldn't work for a few months. So that was kind of frustrating for him. By this time, his ankle had healed enough that, like I said, we went to the World Series parade. But I think given what was going on with his dad at that time, I don't think my grandfather was in the best state of mind to know exactly what was going on. Plus, he was a Cubs fan, but I think that's irrelevant in this case. It was just a lot of things going on with my dad. We grew up in a Cubs family, but he became a White Sox fan. And as someone who had been watching them since the 60s, I'm sure it meant a lot to him. And I know that he appreciated it. Probably did not get as excited about it as I did, because you know, I was 16 years old. I didn't have any responsibilities at that point, unlike Mike at this point, as we have learned. So the White Sox at this point were my entire world. And knowing that they got to the mountaintop while they were my entire world, it was incredible. I did not have the long suffering of decades of futility that many White Sox fans older than me felt, and thus they were crying after this World Series and crying for their fathers and grandfathers who didn't live to see it. But it does not mean that I didn't enjoy it. I just enjoyed it in my own way, as well as probably a 16-year-old can. And obviously, despite everything that the White Sox can do that can get on my nerves and everybody in the fandom's nerves, and they're doing that a lot right now when we're recording this, I hope it doesn't diminish the fact that they did win the World Series. And if they never win another one in our lifetime, at least we have this. And I don't want this to be the only championship they win during my lifetime. But hey, if that's the case, then at least I'll have the memory.
I like that answer. I mean, it's no one can take 2005 away from you. You're decked out in your 2005 World Series gear as we're recording this. I don't blame you. You deserve to enjoy the hell out of this for as long as you can.
And this will obviously be our longest episode by a long shot, which surpasses our 2001 episode, which is only a few weeks old, but I kind of have a feeling that this was going to happen. Even before I insert Mike's answers, this is definitely our longest episode. And thank you so much again to Mike Strubin for giving his insight on a World Series that's often forgotten by the masses. But we know what happened here in Chicago, both Cubs fans and Sox fans. And again, it's something that as I get older, I'll probably learn to appreciate even more, especially if they don't win another one in my lifetime. And it was something that was a major highlight of my life, and probably the best thing that happened to me as a 16-year-old who's dealing with all these changes growing up and dealing with a lot of people who are also going through this. I think this was the perfect thing for my mental health during those teenage years. I don't talk about mental health a lot, but just for my sanity and just to keep certain people at bay. And no disrespect, because the fact that they have beaten the Cubs to that World Series championship drought, it was something that I will take with me for as long as I live. And when my future kids are born, I will tell them about this. And when their kids are born, I'll tell them about that as well, God willing, if I'm still alive at that point. But it's a core memory for me. It will always be a core memory for me. And just thank you to everybody who had a hand in making this 2005 World Series Championship possible. And I will forever be in your debt, as will many other people in this fan base.
And, you know, I remember even at the time, like, even though I was still, like I mentioned, in kind of my staunch anti-White Sox phase, I remember still being, like, legitimately happy for White Sox fans, kind of like with Boston the year before. Of, you know, you've waited a long time. It was great for the city. You mentioned, you know, upwards of 2 million people coming out to celebrate after they had won the whole thing, you know, getting the heroes welcome, coming back in from Houston following that Game 4 victory, and no one can take that away from you. I'm legitimately happy that you guys got to experience the climb to the mountaintop. Enjoy it.
I appreciate that. And like I said last week, I might need some motivation to continue with this podcast after this. But in all fairness, we must. So we look ahead to 2006. It's probably not a good time to be a Cubs fan, because not only has your American League equivalent broken its curse, as well as your crosstown rival broken its curse, but now you have to deal with a team that is not so cursed, but nonetheless a natural rival. And they probably should not be there, all things considered. And they are going up against another team that we have not seen for a while. But in any event, it's going to be a fall classic that probably, even if you take away the feelings that Cubs fans are feeling at this point, probably will not be remembered for the best reasons. Now, granted, it's not like the Black Sox who threw a World Series, but the quality of play will probably leave something to be desired.
I'm pretty sure I actually just happened to see, because we were watching the World Series films on YouTube, and the algorithm, I'm pretty sure, popped up a video about the 2006 World Series that called it the Series of Mid or something to that effect. I don't remember exactly. But if you're looking for motivation to continue doing this, this upcoming series and the play may not be the most inspiring. Maybe let me tease that the events that we will be talking about next week, so tune in next week to find out what happens, but in the background of this happening, were it maybe not for this World Series, this podcast might not exist.
Well, we'll get more into that next week. For Lucas Mitzel, I'm Jeffrey Clark. Again, we did this together in the flesh, not virtually. And we'll be doing this once more. We will get into that when we get to that. But thank you for listening to this very lengthy episode of Thunder 2, History of the World Series. And again, thank you to Mike Struben for his insights. Like us on Facebook, follow us on what will be Twitter to us now and always. Subscribe as well. We will see you next time.